It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's been 50 years since the landmark Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright. The case began in 1961 when Clarence Earl Gideon was arrested and charged with breaking and entering into a Panama City, Florida pool hall and stealing money from the hall's vending machines. At trial, Gideon, who could not afford a lawyer, requested an attorney be appointed to represent him. The judge denied his request, and Gideon was eventually sentenced to 5 years in prison. He appealed, and the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where in 1963 history was made. Joining us now to talk about what happened next and the impact the ruling has half a century later is University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris. David, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, good to be with you.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. So, David, back in 1961, Clarence Earl Gideon is denied an attorney. He loses his case, is sentenced to 5 years in prison. How does this case go to the Supreme Court, and what happens when it gets there?
Well, Mr. Gideon himself wrote his petition for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court. He did not have the aid of a lawyer in doing so. And it's an irony that he himself, without legal assistance, got his case up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court takes the case and declares that the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which says that everybody is entitled to counsel for their defense, that that means that you're not only entitled to bring your own lawyer if you can afford one, but if you can't afford one, you are entitled to the appointment of counsel for your defense paid for by the state. Now, this wasn't intended as an act of charity. This wasn't to lift the poor out of their circumstances. The whole idea here is because the Constitution decrees it, and because it is simply impossible to have a fair trial without legal representation, because it is part of our value system that people in court, hailed into court on charges initiated by the state, people deserve to be represented. That's the only way the trial can be fair, the Supreme Court said. And therefore, anytime you're in court on a felony, you are entitled to assistance of counsel. If you can't pay for it, the state pays for it.
I think a lot of people probably assume that it was always this way, that if someone couldn't afford an attorney,
yes,
one was provided for them. So what was happening before 1963?
Before 1963, a number of states would provide you with an attorney, but it was simply a matter of grace. They didn't have to do that. The Constitution wasn't thought to command it. So, for instance, Florida, where Mr. Gideon's case was, is a good example. They provided for counsel to be appointed if you could not afford it, but only in capital cases, death penalty cases. And other states had different rules, but there was no constitutional minimum. What the Supreme Court did in Gideon was effectively to set a constitutional standard. It's to say, states, when you charge somebody with a felony, you bring them into court, and they can't afford an attorney, you must provide it for them. To not do that is fundamentally unfair.
And before we get into specifically what is all being said here and what rights this established and the legacy of those rights, I want to talk about Clarence Earl Gideon. You mentioned that he wrote this petition on his own behalf. So obviously he was a man who had some intellect. And was he, in fact, the petty thief that he was charged with being?
Well, he did have a record as a petty thief. And this was not his first go-round with the law or his first show up in court. It was part of the reason that he got a five-year sentence and not just let off easy with probation or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the court comments in the case that Mr. Gideon was able to cross-examine witnesses, maybe not as effectively as a lawyer, but he was able to carry it off to make a closing argument and so forth. But nevertheless, the court said, that's not enough. To be able to have counsel for your defense is the guarantee.
And as you pointed out in previous discussions, defending yourself is not always the best way to go. But clearly, this was a man who had some brains. And so why did he end up not going to law school, for example?
No idea. But a person who breaks into pool halls is probably not a candidate for law school or anything else. Let's be clear. I mean, Mr. Gideon was, he was a minor criminal. That doesn't mean he was
apparently
stupid.
A criminal by choice.
Yes. That doesn't mean he was stupid. And when forced to do so, he was able to put words on paper that got the attention of the Supreme Court and got them to declare this right, that it applied in every single state as a constitutional minimum. That's all well and good. But it does not mean that people should, as a general matter, be in there defending themselves. You and I have talked about that. You're right. And it's generally not a good idea. And the Supreme Court says, look, it's just not fair to have people hailed into court on serious charges and not have them have a lawyer.
So now you may have already answered this, but let's go over it specifically. What does Gideon actually say? What right does this establish?
It says that if you are charged with a felony and brought into court on trial, and you want to have a lawyer, of course, you can turn it down. But if you want a lawyer, can't afford one, the state must provide one for you at the state's expense. It is only for felonies.
Does it apply to misdemeanors also?
Not in the Gideon case. We had to wait another 6 or 7 years until the Supreme Court extended the right to counsel to misdemeanors in which a person had a chance of going to jail. If you're in court now, it's not the question of whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. It's whether or not you might go to jail. If a judge says before the case, I'm not going to send you to jail, the judge does not have to appoint counsel, whether felony or misdemeanor. If, on the other hand, there is some chance, not a certainty, but a chance that you might go to jail, you must be appointed counsel if you cannot afford it and you want a lawyer.
We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the 50th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright, the case that established that an attorney should be appointed to all people charged with a felony. If you have a comment or a question, would like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We're talking with one of the best legal minds in the city, so good person to bounce your questions, your ideas, your theories off of. And you can also email us at esspgh@wesa.fm. Don't forget, you can reach us on Twitter. We're there at esspgh. Follow the conversation at #EPLive. So, David, what is the national picture like now? Do people get adequate counsel now, 50 years after Gideon?
Well, generally, Paul, yes, but it's a disappointing effort nationally. We have 50 states, of course. The obligation to give counsel is an obligation of the states. In federal cases, it's a federal obligation, but the vast majority of criminal cases are in the states. All states except two have a statewide public defender system. That is, the states fund it for every county. The two that don't are Utah and Pennsylvania. In many states, there is counsel. It's basically adequate, but nobody is saying that it's the best it could be. Public defenders or appointed lawyers are generally overwhelmed with cases. Their caseloads are too high based on professional standards. They don't have all the access we would want to training or to expert resources. Their offices are often desperately sometimes underfunded. And in a few states that I can think of, Mississippi, Kentucky, some others over the last 10 years, there have actually been federal lawsuits or state lawsuits in which public defender operations come to a judge and say, we cannot take any more cases. You cannot expect us to represent people at the ethical and professional level given the number of cases that we are given and the lack of resources that we have. And in some cases, those litigations have stimulated more resources, have made situations better. In other places, not so much. And in places like Pennsylvania, where public defender services are basically paid county by county, the picture is often quite dire.
there is certainly the perception of the public defender out there that is not particularly flattering. The public defenders seem to be the Rodney Dangerfields of the criminal justice system. They get no respect. Is this justified?
No, I don't think it is. And I have to make full disclosure here. I was a public defender myself in the state of Maryland some years ago now. But generally speaking, the public defenders, when they're in a reasonably well-funded system, have the most exposure to the criminal justice system. They know how to try a case often. They know their way around the courthouse. These are the savviest people usually in the judicial district. They handle criminal cases every day, unlike many appointed or even paid for lawyers. So oftentimes the perception is actually 100% or 180 degrees wrong. You get no respect, but you deserve the most. And it is frustrating to many public defenders. I know that I felt that at times. There are other public defender's offices, I have to say, sadly, where the rap is correct. They're too overworked or too overwhelmed to do much of a job. They're simply there to plead cases out, to feed people into the criminal justice system, and they don't do much. So it's very much a mixed picture, and it depends on what state and what county you end up in.
And are there things that feed that perception of the public defender, maybe the way they're portrayed on television? Maybe to make a point, a producer or director will, write that character or cast them in a way that makes it look as though that person is completely inept.
Yeah, that could be part of it. I think the perception is there in the world even before the media gets a hold of it, to be honest. I dealt with enough clients and enough cases in my time as a public defender to know that many people simply come to the process and come to their public defender lawyer with a strongly established opinion. And sometimes that is because of prior dealings with other public defenders where things haven't worked out so well. So you often come up against the governing assumption, which is, I'll do better if I can raise the money to pay for a lawyer. That's the default position. If you can't, then you're left to the vagaries of the public defender system, and you might get lucky, but probably you won't. I think that really is honestly what people think. They don't actually need the media to pump it into them. It's unfortunate, but it's true.
And what you're saying is you don't necessarily need the money. You don't necessarily have to afford an expensive lawyer in order to get a good defense.
No, it's true. I mean, that's true in Allegheny County. It's true in, I know, the office that I was in. In many places, the public defender lawyers are the best you will possibly be able to do. They're the most motivated. They know how to try a case. And their salary does not depend on whether they go to court or they don't. They're going to get paid the same whether they take your case to trial or they don't, you plead guilty or you don't, which is not necessarily true of paid lawyers. Now, I'm not casting aspersions on them. I'm simply saying that if you pay somebody $500 or $5,000, the less effort they put in, effectively, the more money they make. So you want to choose your lawyers very, very carefully when you're paying them to know that they know how to go to trial and they will go to trial, whether it suits their economic position or not. And you never have to worry about that with a public defender.
And it may be a double-edged sword, too, that someone is paid whether they win or lose the case. That could be a motivating – there could be a case to be made for a lack of motivation, but then at the same time, they're going to do the job the same way regardless of what they're being paid. It's very interesting, and when we come back, I want to talk about just how things look in Pennsylvania and specifically in Allegheny County. We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about 50 years after Gideon versus Wainwright here on Essential Pittsburgh. We'll continue the conversation when we continue on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case, Gideon versus Wainwright. Our guest is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. If you have a comment or question, 412-246-2002, the number to call to get in on the conversation, 412-246-2002. David, before we went to break, we were talking about where things stand in the country on the national scene 50 years after Gideon. In Pennsylvania, and specifically in Allegheny County, are people getting adequate counsel?
Well, Pennsylvania, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, is a very different case than most of the states. Two states, Pennsylvania and Utah, do not have a statewide public defender system. The state has put its obligation to provide counsel for people who are too poor to afford it onto each county. And that means that, of course, we have counties in Pennsylvania that are better off and worse off. That means that public defender services statewide in Pennsylvania are wildly variable. If you have an offense with the public defender in a county over in one side of the state, your experience could be much different than in another corner of the state. This is not new. This is not a secret. The state knows it. There has been talk now and again of having the state carry this burden because it's simply unfair to have it spread this way. Of course, if you're a poor county, not only can you supply less money for this from the get-go, you actually have a need for funds for other services for the poor that might be greater. So the burden is sort of a double whammy. In Allegheny County, we have a public defender office. The last few years, going back actually to 1998, there have been issues with that office. There are many, many fine attorneys there. I know some of those people who work there today. You can get very good representation from that office and from those attorneys. But I think there's a general consensus that the management of that office has not been all it can be over the last 10 or so years. There was a report that was commissioned by the Allegheny County Commissioners just a few years ago, and the results came back, and they were so dispiriting that the county council buried the report, never issued it.
Wow.
It was dug up a couple of years later by the local ACLU, which also did its own report. And when all of that came out, roughly at the same time that Rich Fitzgerald took over as county executive, a change was made at the top of the office. We have, for almost a year now, a new public defender here, and I think people are waiting to see that things turn around. And they're also waiting to see whether the county supplies a more adequate level of funding.
412-246-2002, if you want to join our conversation with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision of Gideon versus Wainwright. Let's go to the phones. We have Mike in Pittsburgh. Mike, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, thank you very much. I wanted to just talk about for a minute. You mentioned, indigent counsel through the public defender's office and, of course, private attorneys, but there actually was, and I assume there still is, in Allegheny County, a third classification of attorneys representing defendants, and that's where you have conflicts of interest, like multiple defendants on a crime, that kind of thing, where you have to have separate counsel, and where there is court-appointed counsel. I remember about 30, 35 years ago, when I was just starting law practice, that I was appointed. I looked for appointments from the criminal courts, and I found I didn't do that for very long because I found that if I represented my client zealously, they tended not to pay me for representing them, meaning going beyond a plea bargain, that kind of thing. And I wonder whether that still exists and. Is that system still work the same way?
Some great points in there. Number one, you do still need conflict counsel. This is when you have more than one defendant in a criminal case. It's very likely that you'll get inconsistent defenses cropping up. Therefore, most public defense systems, even where you have a public defender office, you have to appoint somebody from outside the public defender's office to take over the second and third defendant cases so there isn't a conflict of interest. Because if one attorney represents both and they have inconsistent defenses, you'll have trouble. The second point you make is quite interesting to me. The idea that if you're getting court appointments and you represent your clients very zealously, You stand up, you make a lot of motions in court, whatever it is, that courts will be reluctant to reappoint you, may even not pay you or pay you slowly afterwards. This is a huge concern. I don't know here whether that might still go on. I just have no information about that. Maybe somebody out there does. But that is something that would undermine the independence and the zealous advocacy of lawyers. And that's one of the reasons it's a better thing to have a public defender system instead of an appointed counsel system. Until very recently, Texas ran all of its indigent defense as appointed lawyer cases. And those lawyers are basically subject to the whims of judges for how much money they make. And you can see how that might create a disincentive to be zealous and represent your clients well.
Mike, thank you for that phone call. What about civil cases where a person can't afford a lawyer? What happens there?
That's a great question, Paul. They are not covered at all by the rules we're talking about. Gideon versus Wainwright and the case about misdemeanors called Argersinger, those apply only in the criminal realm. Most states have something like legal aid offices, neighborhood defender offices that are only for civil cases, but those are completely by the grace and the goodwill of the state. There's no constitutional rule that says you're entitled to representation in civil court.
So as we wrap this up, how can states best fulfill their obligations under Gideon 50 years later?
Well, in a state like Pennsylvania, the first answer is a big one, but it's an obvious one. There should be a statewide system funded by the state so you'd have consistent, well-funded representation. The other elements of a good system are independence from the whims of judges who do the appointing, an adequate base of funding so that you can spend enough time on each case, limits on caseloads, adequate training for lawyers, and adequate access to services beyond lawyers like expert witnesses. Those things would go a long way toward making our public defense system as good as it can be and fulfilling the promise of Gideon.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris joining us here in Studio A. As always, great thanks to you.
Very good to be with you, Paul, as always.